A hymn we just sung, I realize some of you don't know the tune too well. It's one of John Newton's tunes. John Newton not only wrote words like Amazing Grace, he also wrote tunes. That one might have seemed a little bit weird to some of you, but it's a great tune when you really get going in. Let's turn together to Joshua chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1. This is the third evening we're in Joshua chapter 1. Do you think that in 6 evenings we're going to get through all the chapters of Joshua? 24 of them? Not at this rate. My father used to teach me a little ditty that went like this. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh were the only two who ever got through to the land of milk and honey. Anyway. Now all say it with me. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, were the only two who ever got through to the land of milk and honey. Now, you'll always remember who got into Canaan. Only two that came out of Egypt that were of age. We'll read from verse 10 of Joshua. And I'm not going to spend much time in the end of Joshua 1 because I do want to get into Joshua 2 tonight. But it says this, verse 10 of Joshua 1, then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves. For within 3 days you are to cross this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess it. And to the Reubenites and to the Gadites and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God gives you rest and will give you this land. Your wives, your little ones, and your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you beyond the Jordan. But you shall cross before your brothers in battle array. All your valiant warriors shall help them until the Lord gives your brothers rest. And as he gives you, and they also possess the land which the Lord, your God, is giving them. Then you shall return to your own land and possess that which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond Jordan toward the sunrise. And they answered Joshua, saying, all that you have commanded us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Anyone who rebels against your command and does not obey the words in all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. Now when we come to this part of Joshua, we have, first of all, in verses 10 and 11, a command to prepare to go. Joshua was in with the camp of Israel in a place called Shittim. Shittim was about 7 miles east of the Jordan River, near where the Allenby Bridge, or does that help you, is today. Or if you were to cross the Jordan, most likely you would cross at the Allenby Bridge. Do not think of any great George Washington Memorial Bridge or Golden Gate Bridge. The Allenby Bridge is a little thing, shorter than this room is, and wide enough just for one bus to cross, not two, just one. And made of metal, it looks like those things, the Bailey Bridges that the Army uses. That's all there is there. And the Jordan River, if you go across it just now, is a ditch. Maybe 8 feet wide and maybe about 1 foot deep. Now, the reason for that is not that the Jordan doesn't have any water, but that the Israelis and the Jordanians are using the water. And they pump it all over the land for irrigation and for drinking and for other purposes. You probably know that water is the most valuable commodity in the Middle East. And there'll be more wars fought over water in the future than anything else in this world. Water is getting very, very precious. And of course, there are people that argue both sides of that. But anyway, if you're thinking of a huge Jordan River, if you see it today, you're going to be disappointed. But it was big then. Not an enormous river, but in flood stage in the springtime, and we're talking April here, it was quite wide, hundreds of yards wide, and it was not possible for them to cross it. Now, they're 7 miles east of Jordan. Where they want to go is into the land of Canaan, toward where Jericho is. Where they were in Shittim, it has acacia trees. It's a more or less desert sort of place. Jericho has palm trees, and it's much less like desert. Both of them are very, very hot in the summertime. Both of them are something like 1,200 feet below sea level. And you add the below sea level to summertime, and it gets warm down there. So nobody is going around in a Northland suit. But Joshua is told here in verse 10 to prepare. God always has chosen to use leaders to lead his people and to do his work. He chose leaders like Moses, leaders like Paul, leaders like some of the great prophets of Samuel, leaders such as the kings like David and Solomon and so on. God has always used leaders. God still uses leaders. And the temptation of some, because leadership is often abused, is to sort of shrink the role of leaders into, well, let's have a vote about it. Democracy, you know, that's God's way, isn't it? Or is it? Is democracy God's form of government? It definitely is not. As Winston Churchill said, democracy is the best form of government except, or is the worst form of government except all the others which have been tried. There's only one good form of government, and that's theocracy, when the Lord himself will be in control. And that is going to happen in the future. It has not happened yet. We're looking forward to the time when the Lord will rule us, rule all those on the earth at that day. Now he says in verse 10 of chapter 1 here, he commanded the officers of the people, and notice immediately after God had finished speaking to him in verse 9, it says, then Joshua commanded the leaders of the people. Joshua obeyed immediately, and Joshua did not try to do it all himself. He co-opted those that were in the chain of command that they might make everything move very smoothly. And so they all wanted to be, the preparation here was necessary because they were going to have to cross the river. Some were going to stay behind. Not everybody, but some. Some were going to go across the river. Those that are going to stay behind, we'll talk about in just a minute. But notice what he says in verse 11. Pass through the midst of the camp, he's telling the officers, and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves, or the old version says victuals, or food, for within 3 days you're to cross Jordan, you're to go in and possess the land. Now, he didn't say sharpen your swords, did he? He didn't say put on your armor. He said prepare food. Make preparation. Prepare provisions for this. Because God was going to be their leader. And God was going to take them in. And at first, they would not need their swords. They had them. And they were going to use them. But not at first. At first, they were going to learn to trust God. And so, for 3 days now, he says, go in and possess the land, for the Lord is going to give you to possess it within 3 days. The number 3 is often significant in Scripture, and often is the number of resurrection. The Lord rose on the 3rd day, and they had 3 days to consider how wide and turbulent the waters of Jordan were. They had 3 days to think about how impossible it was to cross. And they had 3 days to wait for God to do something. And they would have to consider very carefully. God often lets his people wait before he does something marvelous with them. And that happens that way in your life sometimes. You're sure that there's going to be a major step, and then God says, all right, but wait. Now, this waiting period was necessary. We know what was going to happen during those 3 days. Joshua was going to do some planning, and he was going to send some men, spies, across the river to spy out the city of Jericho, to see what kind of defenses it had, and so on. And the people were to consider what was before them and prepare themselves for that time. That's the command to prepare and then wait. Get things ready and then wait for God to move. The second thing that happens in this chapter, or at least this section of the chapter, from verse 12 through verse 18, has to do with the 2.5 tribes that had tempted Joshua and Moses to a compromise. They had recently defeated 2 major kings, King Sihon and King Og. They both occupied the area roughly around the city of Amman today, Amman, Jordan. And these 2 kings had been taken, and 2.5 of the tribes said, this is pretty nice country around here. There is lots of green, still is. There are good pastures, it's great cattle country. Part of it was called Bashan, where there were the bulls of Bashan are mentioned several times in the Old Testament. It was good cattle country, and there were cattlemen, and they wanted to stay there. And so they said, well, let this be our inheritance. That wasn't the first intention. It was that everybody would go across. Those men said, no, let us go there. And if you turn back to Numbers chapter 32, I want to point out just a couple of things about their request. That's where the request is made. And Joshua is answering that request here. Joshua 32, and really the whole chapter is has to do with this. But look at verse 5. Verse 5 says, and they said, if we have found favor in your sight, that is, these 2.5 tribes, it was Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh. These were 2.5 of the tribes of Israel. And they said in verse 5, if we found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us across Jordan. And Moses said to the sons of God and to the sons of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit here? Why are you discouraging the sons of Israel from crossing over into the land which the Lord God has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the sons of Israel so that they did not go into the land which the Lord had given them. So the Lord's anger burned in that day, and so on. And the story goes on about those men from Kadesh. That is the 10 spies, the 12 spies that went up and spied out the land, one from each of the tribes. Now, they asked for a land on the east side of Jordan. Moses says that was a terrible thing to ask. That's a compromise. You're trying to find an easy place. And the end result of it was that those 2.5 tribes promised to send their warriors and go help the others conquer the west side of the river, the west bank, if you will. That's why the west bank is called that today. It includes all of the land of Israel. Well, today it's a little more specialty, but it includes most of what we know today as the land of Israel, from Hebron right up to almost the Sea of Galilee, and all that land in there, including Jerusalem and so on, all called the West Bank even today. So the men of these 2 tribes were to go up and help them. That was compromise. And God permitted it, as he often does. But it wasn't their best, for their best good. You know, too many Christians are something like that. They're satisfied to dwell on the borders of the land, but never actually enter it themselves. Their homes were outside the land, even though they fought a few battles inside it. And they never really enjoyed the land itself. And the result, and I'm just going to say this quickly, is that they gradually were cut off from the life of the nation. They were the last to come to the feasts and Passover feasts in Jerusalem. There were few great names that came from those tribes that dwelt in that land because they were sort of cut off from life of everything that was going on. And when captivity came, guess who went first? They. Now, we haven't time to look at all those scriptures, but Joshua acceded to their request, but he needed unity, so he says, you must come over and fight for it. And their response is really pretty good. Look at what they say. Joshua said in verse 14, you shall cross before your brothers in battle array, all your valiant warriors, and you shall help them. Notice Joshua is going to send them first. You shall cross before your brothers until the Lord gives your brothers rest. And he gives you, as he gives you, and they also shall possess the land which the Lord your God has given them. Then you shall return to your own land. And they say in verse 17, they answered, just as we obeyed Moses, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. And they went even beyond the claims of Moses. They said, if anybody rebels, we will slay him. We will kill him. And they kept their promise. And if we had time, we could turn to Joshua chapter 22 and find out that when the conquest of Canaan was complete, they are complimented because they stayed, they kept their word, they fought with Israel until the battles were won, and then they were allowed to go home. And they went home with really honors. In that time, their response is really quite inspiring, and so that'll be enough for chapter 1. I want to turn now to chapter 2, and I basically want to look tonight at Rahab. Anybody ever named their daughter Rahab? I've never heard of a Rahab. I did know a couple of Delilahs. We had one at Emmaus, and that never ceased to amaze me. But we've never had a Rahab. But you know, Rahab is one of the great heroes of faith in all of Scripture. Rahab is listed along with Abraham and Sarah and Jacob and some of the greats in Hebrews chapter 11. And there's Rahab right along with them. Most of us tend to remember Rahab for her former life. God remembered her for what she did by faith. And would to God there were more Rahabs around. We'll see something of what God was going to do through this woman. And you might want to set up a sort of TV thriller and call it something like this. The spies and the prostitute. And, yes, you could do it that way. But the real story of chapter 2 of Joshua has to do with the faith of a woman who believed in God and acted on her belief. And we see something of the power of God in her life because of her obedience to the word of God the spies teach us something about possessing our inheritance. Now, the spy mission occurs during that 3-day period that the rest of Israel was to wait on the other side. Sometimes we criticize this story. Sometimes Joshua himself is criticized for waiting. But Joshua was a general, and generals plan their strategy. And God allowed him to plan his strategy. Then God gave him the strategy. But it's always a good idea for leaders to know where they're going. Have you ever met leaders? And I have met lots of them. They're like Columbus. They have no idea where they're going. And when he got there, he had no idea where he was. And when he got back, he had no idea where he'd been. He was trying to go to India. He thought he was in the East Indies. And he was nowhere near any of those places, was he? Too many leaders like that. Joshua planned and went carefully. And there are two great illustrations of faith in this chapter, and I want you to get them if we get nothing else tonight. First of all, there's Rahab's faith, and she believed there was a coming judgment of God, and she acted on it. We'll see that in chapter 2 here. And then there was the faith of these men we call spies. They had faith in the power of God to give Israel the land that he had promised to them. But let's look at Rahab first as to how God opens her life story up to us. She's mentioned twice in the New Testament. Both of them commend her for her faith. And we'll see that in just a bit. She's mentioned in Hebrews 11. She's also mentioned in James chapter 2. And one more comment before we look at the passage. And this is something that confuses many of God's dear people. Maybe it confuses you, because God seems to be doing opposite things sometimes in the same set of circumstances. Two opposite things. And very often they have a sovereign side and a consequential side. By a consequential side, says, if I jump in the river, I get wet. That's the consequences of jumping in the river. That's a consequential side to things. The people living in the land of Canaan had sinned, grossly sinned against God. Their cup of iniquity was now full. And the consequences of their action is that God was going to destroy them, man, woman, and beast. And God had already announced this beforehand. He had waited until the exact proper moment, and that was going to happen. And God was also going to give his people at the same time their land. And they're going to find their cities already with walls. They're going to find their farms all set up. They're going to find the implements for the farms all ready to go. And God was going to do that to them. So he's judging the Canaanites, and he's rewarding the Israelites at the same time. That's the consequential side. But beyond both of those consequences, God was also fulfilling his overarching sovereign purposes. God was fulfilling his promise at the right moment in history. God is going to arrange a lot of things, and including the line of Messiah himself. And that line of Messiah is going to include our heroine, Rahab. And God is arranging these things sovereignly. So he works consequentially, he works sovereignly. And sometimes these things don't appear to make sense to us. You know why? Because we're not God. And we can't always figure out God. Can you allow God to be a little bigger and smarter than you are? Can you allow God to be wiser than you are? Some Christians have a great deal of time, especially theologians. You know, theologians love to get everything in neat little square boxes. But you know what? Some of the truths are round. And they don't always fit neatly into the square boxes. Pigeonholes, that the theologians would like to get them all arranged in a systematic theology. God didn't give us a systematic theology. He gave a book gave us a book which is largely history about himself and about what he's doing. And from that, the clever ones try and develop systematic theologies. Meanwhile, us poor folks, we just seek to learn to know God and his ways. Here's Rahab. And she's living in a city called Jericho. And she's a Gentile. She's not a Jew. And she's an Amorite, the most wicked of all the Canaanite tribes. And beyond that, she's a prostitute. Not a very likely prospect. And this is the person that God is going to deal with. Now, let's read some of the chapter. Then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, "Go, view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab, and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, "Bring out those men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." They had been seen going into her house. And it came about, verse 4, "But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, 'Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from.' And it came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out, and I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." Some of you will recognize that that wasn't all strictly kosher. There were three wonderful lies right in there. Verse 6, "But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate." Now, let's stop there for a minute. Jericho was ruled by a king, a wicked king of Canaan. And these kings of Canaan picture for us some of the principalities and powers that are strong in the world. Ephesians 6 mentions that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And that's what's pictured here very clearly. And this prince of Jericho, the king of Jericho, was like the prince of this world. Jericho was not very far from Sodom and Gomorrah. They knew that story. It had happened 500 years before, and it was well known, and everybody knew about it. And they knew about the God that caused the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, too. And then there's not only the king of Canaan, there's Rahab, the Gentile, the Amorite, the prostitute. And Rahab has heard some stories. Maybe some of the visitors in her house had told her about the exploits of the children of Israel marching through the desert and defeating the kings across the river, King Og and King Sihon, defeating before that the Moabites, and having crossed the Red Sea, and God had opened the way, and now they were on the shores of the Jordan River, looking right across, and you can see easily from Jericho, right across the Red Sea, to where they were. They saw those 2 million people camped there, and they were worried. And Rahab was thinking, their God is a great God. Their God is the only God. Their God should be my God. And she is considering all these things. And eventually Rahab is saved from God's judgment. And she's made part of the people of God. And she comes into the line of Messiah himself. Theologians, writers on Joshua generally think that Rahab's faith was a very true faith. I want you to notice what she says when she meets these spies. I'm not going to tell you the story too much because you're well aware of, of how the men went in. Now, before she lay down, verse 8, before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof, and she said to them, I know that the Lord has given you the land. She knew the name of Yahweh, Jehovah. She knew the promise of Jehovah to give them the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us. She knew that the people in Jericho were shaking in their boots, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you, for we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you. And when you came out of Egypt, what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. And Rahab has rejected the authority of her own king in Jericho. She is identifying herself with the people of God. She's concerned about salvation, and we'll see that, particularly for her relatives. And eventually she becomes a link in the line of Messiah. Now, commentaries talk a lot about Rahab and what she was doing and why she was doing it. Some tell you that they think she was no longer a practicing prostitute, but she was still known for it. We used to have a man in Zululand. His name was Komo, but they called him Killer Komo because at some time in the past he had murdered another, and he was always known as Killer Komo. Simon the leper, for instance, in the New Testament, no longer had leprosy, but he was known all his life as Simon the leper. They say that Rahab the harlot is called that because every time Rahab's name is mentioned, her occupation is mentioned along with it, even in the New Testament. But at least it tells us what she was. Some people think that Rahab actually had left harlotry, prostitution, and had taken up making garments, and they argue something like this, and you can play with it in your own mind if you like, that she had flax on the roof, and people dried flax on the roof because they were going to make materials. And making materials was very difficult work. That wasn't usually what prostitutes were interested in doing it. And so they argue that Rahab was now a seamstress, and she's making material with which to make things. And she had this red cord, and they can find some evidence that red cord was full of dye and was used as little bits of it were cut off and put in the dye lot, and that would make it the red color that they were looking for. And so they look at the dye in the red cord, and they look at this flax on the roof, and they tell you that now she is a seamstress and not a prostitute. You can take your pick on that one. God doesn't make much of that at all. What does God make much of? Her faith. That's what God sees. And she had heard these stories, and she was beginning to believe in God, and she does indeed. And her faith is tested right away. Focus of the chapter is always on what she believed. God had brought the spies to her door. How they got there? Well, they probably came right up to the walls of Jericho. A few weeks ago, I was there. You can visit this old city. And they have dug down, and you could find old towers that belonged in that city. You can see pieces of the wall that have fallen down. We mentioned that. And you can walk right round. It doesn't take very long because it wasn't very big in the sense of our cities. They take you, half an hour to walk around the whole thing. Not that long, not that big. The walls, part of the old ancient cities, was usually relatively small. It had a stepped mud brick wall. That is a wall that went up like this in two big steps with a step in the middle. And you can see where the bricks from the top part came down on the bricks on the bottom part, and they're all scattered. They fell down. The archaeologists say it was an earthquake. But if God wanted to send a well-timed earthquake at exactly the moment the trumpets blew, is that okay with you? It's okay with me. I don't know how he knocked them down. Doesn't say an earthquake, did it? But if God wanted to use the earthquake to do it, that's fine. Rahab became interested in these men when they knocked on her door. They came to her because they would be least noticed there in a place like that where travelers often came. They'd be least likely to be asked any questions. They wanted to find out something, and they probably came to a very good place for that. But they had been seen. And Rahab knows what is about to happen. She somehow feels that there's going to be a knock on her door very, very soon. And so she has the spies hidden at the top. She has not yet had a chance to speak to them very much. But that's her first act of faith, is to hide those men up on the roof. And then we see that she risked her life. And she risked her life by telling three lies. Yes, she says in verse 4, the men came, but I did not know where they were from. Lie number 1. And it came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark, the men went out. Lie number 2. And I do not know where the men went. Lie number 3. Now, people for the last 2,000 years have been having a lot of fun with Rahab's lies. Was it right to lie? Did she lie by faith? Do you have to tell truth to government people that are going to kill you if you do? What do you say when you're smuggling Bibles on the border of Russia when it's a communist country? And they say, have you anything to declare? You say, I've got a load of Bibles here? Is that what Brother Andrew says? Oh, no, it isn't. And this has been played with over and over again. I haven't got all the answers for you, but I do know this, that Rahab believed in God. Rahab acted not out of purity or solid truth, but out of her cultural way and how wrong it was. You may judge yourself, but she got the government guys to go away. her own life was spared, and the life of those men. After all, her life was at stake along with theirs. She knew that, and so they went away. You can figure out all of these kinds of things later for yourself. But her faith, I think, is remarkable when she finally gets to talk to the men and when she tells them what kind of things that she knew about God already. And she told them that she knew God had given them the land. And she told them that the terror of the Lord had fallen on them. And she told them that she'd heard about the Red Sea, and she'd heard about Sihon and Gog and Og and those kings over on the other side of the river. And she said this, and this is the remarkable thing, and this is why most commentators believe she was already a believer in God, if not yet a believer in the coming sacrifice for sin, the Lord Jesus. Because she said, the Lord your God, he is God in heaven and in earth. It's almost a quote from Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 39. I find it very interesting that at Kadesh Barnea, it was Israel who was scared silly, looking at the land. Now, in Jericho, when these spies come, it is the Canaanites who are afraid of the Israelites. And so her testimony had a powerful effect on these men. Now notice her unselfish request. Rahab is looking at the future. Rahab knows the army is coming. Rahab knows the city is going to be destroyed. And Rahab, in verse 12, says, "Now therefore, please swear to me." And this is her request. "Please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sister with sisters, with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." So the men said to her, "Our life for yours, if you do not tell this business of ours. And it shall come about when the Lord gives you the land that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." Then she lets them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, for she was living on the wall. And she tells them, "Go to the hill country," and believe me, that's very near. The Judean hills ride right out of old Jericho. "Go to the hill country on the west side, and lest your pursuers happen on you, and hide yourselves there for 3 days, until the prisoners return, then afterward you may go your way." And that's the deal that they made. Now, Rahab requested salvation for her, and the sign of her request was to be this cord that was going to hang out the window. I don't think that we can make an immediate association between the red cord and the blood of Christ, although most Sunday school lessons think it right away. I'm not sure that was in God's mind at all. It was a cord that could be seen. It was a cord she had. It was a cord that was to mark her home, and that those within that home were going to be saved. I think that's the thing that's closer to it. I think if we wanted to link it with anything more closely in the Bible, we ought to link it with the blood that was put on the doorpost at Passover. And that blood marked a home in which the firstborn would not come under judgment. But notice three rewards that Rahab got in verses 23 and 24. I'm not going to take too much more time in this chapter. Look at the end now, at the end of the chapter. "Then the two men returned," you know the story, "and came down from the hill country and crossed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun, and they related to him all that happened. And they said to Joshua, 'Surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands.'" The first reward that came from Rahab's faith was that Israel was encouraged to go in. The spies found out that all of Jericho was trembling because of them. That encouraged them to go. That encouraged them that God was already at work in their lives. And Rahab's confession had given rise to that. Then we see something about her own salvation. Rahab herself believed in God. Later she became an Israelite, a proselyte. And Rahab became in the line of Messiah himself. And she's incorporated into the nation of Israel. She marries a man called Salmon. And Salmon's father was Nashon. And if we had time to go back to number 7, we could find that Nashon was one who offered great sacrifices to the Lord. He was a prince in the tribe of Judah. And it was Nashon's son, Salmon, that Rahab married. And their son was Boaz. And Boaz married Ruth. And Boaz and Ruth then have a son, which is going to be in the line of Messiah, coming down in two more generations to David and Jesse, his father, and so on. Rahab's salvation was due to the grace of God. And God gave her a believing husband and who was a prince in Israel, and she bears one who would be in the line of Israel. Now, two passages in the New Testament, as we close, that have to do with Rahab. First one's in Hebrews 11:31. Do I hear those Bibles? Hebrews 11:31. Hebrews 11 is the great chapter of the heroes and heroines of faith. And in verse 31, among those by faith Abel, by faith Enoch, by faith Noah, by faith Abraham, by faith Sarah, by faith Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, and Moses, and so on. And now in verse 31, by faith Rahab, the harlot, did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Rahab is saved by faith because she welcomed the spies, not because she hung the red cord, because she welcomed the spies. Turn to James chapter 2, verse 25. James chapter 2, only a couple of pages further on in your Bible. And it says this, and in the same way, he's saying that a man is justified by works and not by faith, and in the same way, was not Rahab the harlot, she's still called the harlot, also justified by works when she received, does it say spies? She received the messengers and sent them out by another way. Both the author of Hebrews and James mentions her receiving of these men. In Hebrews, they're called spies. In James, they're called messengers. In fact, Rahab becomes a kind of link in the great argument over works and faith that James is producing. And he uses Rahab as an example of one who was justified by works. Does that mean God saves us on the basis of our good works? No, it doesn't. It means that those who are truly justified exemplify their faith. They act out their faith by their works. And Rahab had faith. And she acted on the basis of her faith in receiving those spies and protecting them and realizing that they were messengers of God. And she believed on that and therefore came into relationship with God herself. And she, in receiving them, she received the God who sent them. So there's some great lessons we could learn. We can learn a lesson of God's interest in reaching out to people. Joshua didn't need to send those spies in order to find out about Jericho, because God already had a plan. But God had a person inside Jericho he was after. In fact, a whole house full of them. Because she brought her relatives and said, if you believe in God, this city is going to be destroyed. And the only safe place in this whole city is going to be in my house. And you better get there quick. Because you see those Israelites coming across that river? They're going to be here in a day or two. And we better be ready. And so they had a house full. I imagine they had quite a house full. Believing in God.